Hello, my name is Dave Emery, and this is side one of For the Record program number 578, titled Darkness at Sunrise, the Interdiction of Operation Safe Haven. This program is being recorded on November 26th of the year 2006. In this broadcast, we're going to be taking a look at some of the events that led to the creation of something that I refer to often in this program. That entity is the Borman Capital Network. This may seem utterly crazy to new listeners. I can't stress strongly enough that listeners should use the materials available on the Spitfire website and on linked websites, including and especially a number of the old anti-fascist books that are available for download for free on that website. And one of those books is the 1981 text Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile by Paul Manning. What we're going to be looking at in this broadcast is how the forces that, first of all, operated within the international cartel system to help to finance and arm Nazi Germany in the first place worked feverishly to destroy Operation Safe Haven. Operation Safe Haven was the U.S. Treasury Department operation that was in charge with blocking the Nazi flight capital program. It was the success of that flight capital program and the recreation of the Nazi political structure and the recreation of the Nazi economic structure within the framework of the international cartel system that basically spawned the Borman Network, about which I speak so often. The Borman Network is the economic component of a Third Reich that went underground and perpetuated itself in mafia-like fashion. Recall that the Mafia began as a resistance movement in 12th and 13th century Sicily to first Norse, i.e. Viking, then Saracen, i.e. Turk or Arab invaders. Well, the 12th and 13th century is a long time ago, but the Mafia is still present in Sicily, and it's not just present in Sicily, it's present here as well. The Third Reich did something somewhat analogous. What permitted the successful outflow and then ultimate repatriation of the Nazi wealth, the foundation of the Borman Capital Network, was the interdiction, the frustration of Operation Safe Haven. And we're going to take a look at how that happened. Operation Safe Haven, again, was directed by the U.S. Treasury Department. Key names involved here. First of all, Secretary of the Treasury Morgenthau. We're going to take a look at him. He wanted to basically deindustrialize Germany in order to punish it for launching the war of aggression. Morgenthau was the Secretary of the Treasury, and two of his key aides, Harry Dexter White and Lachlan Curry, are also going to be focal points here. We're going to look not only at how Safe Haven was interdicted, but ultimately how the conspiratorial forces that interdicted Safe Haven, an interplay of American industrialists, financiers, and lawyers who doubled as intelligence chiefs, collaborated with high-ranking SS men as well as some of their German industrial and financial counterparts, and how ultimately not only was Safe Haven neutralized, but people such as Morgenthau and ultimately Harry Dexter White and Lachlan Curry were politically neutralized and discredited by the anti-communist witch hunts. First of all, we're going to take a look at an excerpt of a document that was compiled in 1997 under the auspices of the U.S. State Department. It discussed the Nazi flight capital program, and it discussed the origins of the Safe Haven program. The URL for this document will be in the description for the broadcast. Describing Operation Safe Haven, this document says, as the tide of battle shifted in favor of the Allies in 1943, economic warfare goals began to take into account the concern that Germany would try to hide gold and other assets abroad so they would not be included in war reparations and could be used to rebuild Axis strength in the post-war period. The specific goals of Safe Haven, as they came to be formulated in the spring of 1944, were to restrict and prevent German economic penetration beyond Germany, to block Germany from transferring assets to neutral countries, to ensure that German wealth would be accessible for war reparations and for the rehabilitation of Europe, to make possible the return to legal owners of properties looted from countries once occupied by the Germans, and to prevent the escape of strategic German personnel to neutral havens. The overall purpose was to make it impossible for Germany to start another war. And of Treasury Secretary Morgenthau, we read, Secretary of the Treasury Morgenthau in September of 1944 put forward his plan for the political reform of a defeated Germany through punishment, partition, and pastoralization, i.e. deindustrialization. The radical downscaling of German economy envisioned under the Morgenthau plan would rule out any substantial reparations to the victors, except what might be obtained from the dismantlement of what remained of German industry at the end of the war. While President Roosevelt appeared at first to approve of the Treasury plan for a punitive peace for Germany, and he and Prime Minister Churchill went some distance in adopting some of its elements during their wartime meeting at Quebec in September of 1944, opposition developed from Secretary of War Henry Stimson, who feared it would foster resentment in Germany and give rise to another war with Germany. The State Department also opposed the pastoralization of the German economy called for in the Treasury plan and favored a system of controls that would bring Germany into the family of nations. Note that Secretary of War Henry Stimson's top aide here was John J. McCloy, later chairman of the Chase Manhattan Bank, also eventually U.S. High Commissioner for Germany, who basically saw to it that denazification was for all intents and purposes frustrated and that many of the worst Nazi war criminals, including some of the people we're going to be looking at in this program, went to work for elements of U.S. intelligence. The State Department also was opposed to the Morgenthau Plan, and ultimately the acting Secretary of State was former U.S. Ambassador to Japan, Joseph Grew, who was a Morgan protege. So note the attitude of then Treasury Secretary Morgenthau in charge of the department that was overseeing safe haven towards Germany. Eventually, Morgenthau was turned out as Secretary of the Treasury, and safe haven, as we're going to see, was frustrated. One of Morgenthau's top aides overseeing Operation Safe Haven was Harry Dexter White, who, as we will see, was not only to become a casualty of Joe McCarthy's anti-communist witch hunts, but who also basically was deep-sixed, at least in part, by some of the people who were involved with compromising Safe Haven. Skipping down in this document, to provide embassies with expertise in safe haven-related issues, on October 31, 1944, Treasury Secretary Morgenthau agreed with Treasury General Counsel Joseph O'Connell and Harry Dexter White, Director of Monetary Research for the Treasury Department, that Treasury-trained financial intelligence officers should be dispatched to supplement the staff of embassies in response to the increased outflow of Axis capital and goods from the German Reich to neutral havens. So note Harry Dexter White's position as a key aide to Morgenthau and in Operation Safe Haven. We're going to take a look now at Lachlan Curry, who, among other things, undertook a mission to Switzerland in early 1945 in order to rein in, and this was obviously unsuccessful, the Swiss role in serving as a conduit for Nazi monies to escape abroad. The arrival of the Curry mission in Bern in February of 1945 represented both a substantial and psychological watershed for the Swiss. Since the Allied landings in June of 1944, the German army had steadily retreated, and for the first time in over 4 years, Switzerland was not surrounded by the German army, opening the possibility to expand trade and communication with the non-Axis world. Skipping down. Despite official Swiss concern about his mission, Curry was impressed with the popular enthusiasm that greeted his arrival on the first train to Bern from a recently liberated Paris. Throughout his stay, in fact, Curry received red carpet treatment, the details of which appeared in much of his correspondence about the mission. Note this next sentence. It is likely that the lavish Swiss hospitality afforded Curry and his colleagues contributed to some degree to the optimistic interpretation of the mission's outcome. And note that, obviously, as implied there, Lachlan Curry was quite optimistic about the outcome of his mission, but that optimism was not borne out. What we're going to take a look at next, and for the remainder of the program, is how Operation Safe Haven was interdicted by pro-fascist and pro-Nazi conspirators on both sides of the Atlantic, including and especially people in the United States who wore the twin hat, so to speak, of both industrialist, financier, slash lawyer, and as key intelligence operatives. What we're going to look at next concerns some plans that Franklin Delano Roosevelt had for placing the American and British industrialists and financiers who'd backed Hitler in the defendant's dock at Nuremberg alongside their German compatriots. The point being here that had Roosevelt lived and had the plans of Morgenthau and also the success of Operation Safe Haven been realized, some of the most important American industrialists and financiers, including the grandfather and great-grandfather of George W. Bush, including people like Alan Dulles, a former director of the CIA, including some of the most prominent names in American industry and finance, would have been in the defendant's dock at Nuremberg for having financed Hitler. That was not to be, and we're going to take a look at why not. We're going to turn next to The Secret War Against the Jews, co-authored by John Loftus and Mark Ahrens, and we read of Roosevelt's plan to place American and British backers of Hitler in the defendant's dock at Nuremberg. But the one issue upon which Franklin Roosevelt was unyielding was his insistence that after the war, the German bankers must stand in the dock at the Nuremberg war crimes trial. This is confirmed by the top-secret White House Justice Department correspondence files. The plan was to wait until Abs, Krupp, Flieg, and the rest of the German industrialists were charged. Then Treasury Secretary Morgenthau would unleash the wiretap evidence showing that the Nazis had hidden their stolen assets in Switzerland with the help of Alan Dulles. Parenthetically, Alan Dulles at this point was working for the Office of Strategic Services in Bern, Switzerland. That was America's World War II intelligence agency. It was overseen by General William Wild Bill Donovan, who we're going to take a look at in a minute. Note that Alan Dulles, along with his brother John Foster Dulles, were key partners in the Sullivan and Cromwell law firm, the powerful Wall Street law firm that was instrumental in secreting American investments in the Nazi economy, as well as facilitating those investments. Continuing with Loftus and Ahrens' account, the whole and this is if Roosevelt's plans had gone through. The plan was to wait until Abs, Krupp, Flieg, and the rest of the industrialists were charged. Then Morgenthau would unleash the wiretap evidence showing that the Nazis had hidden their stolen assets in Switzerland with the help of Alan Dulles. The whole scandal of Western aid to the German economy would unravel. All the slights of the Standard Oil blackmail would be avenged. The sudden release of the Safe Haven intercepts would force a public outcry to bring treason charges against those British and American businessmen who aided the enemy in time of war. The targets included not only the Dulles brothers, but Forrestal and major industrialists such as Henry Ford. From a prosecutor's point of view, indicting the German bankers first was a brilliant strategy. To save themselves, Hermann Abs and Hjalmar Schacht would have to reveal the whole history of their sordid dealings with companies such as Ford Motor. Despite the shields of Swiss banking laws and the layers of corporations that Dulles had erected, he had never anticipated that the Swiss bank codes and cables would ever become public knowledge. Roosevelt and Morgenthau would have hanged him and all his colleagues for ever breaking the power of the pirates of international finance. It was a glorious dream, yet the scheme completely fell apart because someone tipped off Dulles that he was under surveillance. And skipping down. Because he learned about the Safe Haven intercepts so quickly, Dulles knew that there was no smoking gun against him. His work for the Nazis prior to the war was not illegal, let alone treasonous. His wartime communications with the Nazis, although highly embarrassing, could be excused as an exercise in deception or as part of his intrigues to overthrow Hitler. Although many of his wartime actions were unauthorized, they were not criminal. What was criminal was the way that Dulles was trying to help the German industrialists get their money out at the end of the war. After the Nazis' 1943 defeat at Stalingrad, various Nazi businessmen realized they were on the losing side and made plans to evacuate their wealth. The Perón government in Argentina was receiving the Nazi flight capital with open arms, and Dulles helped it to hide the money. This was more than a violation of the Trading with the Enemy Act. Giving aid and comfort to the enemy in time of war was treason. But once again, Allen Dulles was one step ahead of his pursuers. After the Nazis tipped him off that the Allies had broken the Swiss codes, Dulles had carefully shifted the scope of his money laundering from Switzerland to the Central Bank of Belgium. Now we're going to review something we've looked at in past programs, namely the pivotal role in the frustration of Operation Safe Haven of an intelligence front slash corporate entity called the World Commerce Corporation. Now, this was put together by the aforementioned Allen Dulles. In this, Dulles worked not only with William Wild Bill Donovan, who was head of the OSS, and who, as an attorney, had worked very closely with the Morgan Group, and in particular, Wild Bill Donovan had channeled a Morgan money to right-wing Germans in the early 1920s to fortify German anti-communism. In addition to Wild Bill Donovan, in the World Commerce Corporation, founded by Allen Dulles, we're going to see William Stevenson, who was in charge of all British intelligence operations in the Americas during World War II, and also, in a couple of minutes, Edward Stettinius, who was a key Morgan partner. The purpose of the World Commerce Corporation was to recycle the Nazi money that had successfully escaped Europe under Operation Safe Haven and to recycle it back into Germany in order to finance German economic recovery and the, quote, economic miracle, unquote, of Germany. It was the World Commerce Corporation, as we shall see, inextricably linked with U.S. intelligence operations and at a more fundamental level with some of the highest echelons of American industry, law, and finance. It was the World Commerce Corporation that assured that Operation Safe Haven would be neutralized and that ultimately the Bormann Flight Capital Program would be successful in channeling the enormous stolen wealth, $180 billion in early 40s dollars by the end of 1943 alone, according to British intelligence. That money was successfully repatriated back into Germany to basically generate the Bormann Capital Network, about which I speak so often. Of the genesis of the World Commerce Corporation and its role basically in nailing shut the coffin of Operation Safe Haven, we read as follows in The Secret War Against the Jews by Loftus and Ahrens. In 1945, with Roosevelt dead, Operation Safe Haven stifled, Truman ignorant, and British intelligence chief Menzies cooperating, Dulles thought that he had gotten away with his schemes with the Nazis. Soon after the Safe Haven inquiry into his own Nazi money smuggling was buried, Allen Dulles resigned from the OSS and returned to New York to do what he did best, move money illegally for his clients. One of the first names on his client list was a personal matter for Thomas McKittrick, the head of the previously Nazi-dominated Bank of International Settlements, or BIS, in Switzerland. The BIS had overseen the transfer of Nazi assets to Switzerland. After the war, the Nazis moved the money via the Vatican to Argentina. Dulles represented a staggering array of Argentine corporate and political entities before and after the war. President Juan Perón and his family were ardent Catholics and violently anti-communist, as were many Argentines. Parenthetically, as noted on page 205 of the Manning text, Juan Perón had also been banking since 1941 in a joint account with Martin Bormann, who banked under his own name. Continuing, in fact, Perón was decidedly pro-fascist, and Argentina was the only South American country that continued relations with the Third Reich well into the war. The Argentine economy boomed with the massive post-war transfer of Nazi flight capital. Skipping down. In the meantime, Dulles and his former chief, William Wild Bill Donovan, agreed that every effort must be made to sabotage the Truman liberals and quietly prepare for the Cold War. To this end, Dulles convinced Donovan to serve on the board of a company that would help rebuild the German economy as a bulwark against communism. Dulles assured his old boss that there were a large number of wealthy South American investors, especially in Argentina, who were willing to help rebuild Germany. Although Donovan did not know it, Dulles had conned him into serving as the front man for the Nazi money launderers. He and Sir William Stevenson from British Intelligence joined the board of directors of the World Commerce Corporation, with Alan Dulles, naturally, as their lawyer. The Nazi money flowed in a great circle out of the Third Reich, through the Vatican, to Argentina, and back to, quote, democratic, unquote, West Germany. The source of the miraculous West German economic revival in the 1950s was the same money that had been stolen in the 1940s. More about some of the participants in the World Commerce Corporation, we're going to read now from the book The Old Boys by Burton Hirsch, subtitled The American Elite and the Origins of the CIA. And one of the people, in addition to Wild Bill Donovan and Alan Dulles and William Stevenson, one of the people that we're going to look at in the nomenclature of the World Commerce Corporation is Edward Stettinius. Now, Edward Stettinius was a key Morgan partner. Also, the London Hambro family were key international bankers. Turning to The Old Boys by Burton Hirsch of Wild Bill Donovan and the World Commerce Corporation, we read, ostensibly to promote recovery, he, Donovan, William Stevenson, and Edward Stettinius, along with members of the London Hambro family and quite a delegation of other at-large big shots, started the World Commerce Corporation, a Panama-registered entity which seemed to fall somewhere between an import-export combine and a commercially-oriented espionage network. Primary among its functions would seem to have been the re-equipping and upgrading of the German industrial plant. In other words, basically, helping the enormous stolen wealth that the Nazis had appropriated in World War II find its back to the German economy, where, as the German core corporations were reintegrated into the international cartel system that had helped to spawn Nazi Germany in the first place, those German corporations were the beneficiaries of that wealth. More now about the World Commerce Corporation. This from yet another John Loftus and Mark Aaron's text, Unholy Trinity, the Vatican, the Nazis, and the Swiss Banks. By the way, both volumes, both Loftus and Aaron's volumes, are published by the St. Martin's Press. Of the World Commerce Corporation, we read in Unholy Trinity of the recycling of money out of Germany, down to Latin America, and then back to Germany. The most important front group was an entity called the World Commerce Corporation, established after World War II to rebuild German-South American trade networks. The directors of this operation were Sir William Stevenson, formerly of British Intelligence, and General William Donovan, formerly of the OSS. One of the attorneys for World Commerce was Alan Dulles, whose assistant, Frank Wisner, was the State Department's deputy for currency and economic reform in the American zone of West Germany. Many of the staff members for the economic reconstruction of occupied Germany came from the same international financial firms which had invested heavily in the pre-war German economy. Note here also that Alan Dulles, who was one of the attorneys for the World Commerce Corporation, had as his assistant Frank Wisner, the State Department deputy for currency and economic reform. Eventually, Frank Wisner, who was also a key OSS operative along with Dulles, under William Donovan, now part, as of in the immediate post-war period, part of the World Commerce Corporation. Frank Wisner had also been a partner in the law firm of Carter, Ledyard, and Milburn. At one point, under Alan Dulles, not only Frank Wisner, but also another Carter, Ledyard, Milburn partner, Harding Jackson, were deputy directors of the CIA when Alan Dulles was CIA chief. By the way, Carter, Ledyard, and Milburn, for many years, was the chief counsel for the New York Stock Exchange, owned by the Dow Jones Company. Still more about the World Commerce Corporation and its role working with Alan Dulles and some of these at-large big shots, as Burton Hirsch calls them, and the Vatican to frustrate Operation Safe Haven. Skipping ahead in Unholy Trinity by Loftus and Ahrens. Laundered through the untraceable Vatican Bank, the Nazi treasure moved from Switzerland to South America. There, the stolen funds were invested in a number of Argentine businesses whose lawyer was, of course, Alan Dulles. As the final act of the money laundering, Dulles created the World Commerce Corporation to revive trade between Argentina and West Germany. On its board were such notables as William Donovan of U.S. intelligence and William Stevenson of British intelligence. During the 1950s, much of the stolen proceeds were laundered back to Germany for the great economic revival of West Germany. In the end, the money went back to the original German companies and their Western investors. It is not Swiss bank accounts that we should be tracing, it is the stock ownership of the Swiss banks. There lies the last and perhaps the ugliest secret of World War II. And therein lies the major culpability of the Vatican in its relations with Hitler's Germany. Without the Vatican's investments in the Third Reich, there could not have been the motive to provide the means to smuggle the Nazis' plundered loot from Switzerland through the Vatican Bank. So note the role of the Vatican along with Alan Dulles, Frank Wisner, William Stevenson, Edward Stettinius, and Wild Bill Donovan in overseeing the operations or facilitating the operations of the World Commerce Corporation. And it was that corporation that was the official vehicle for the frustration of Operation Safe Haven. What we're going to be taking a look at inside two of the program is the operation that gives the title to this broadcast. That was something called Operation Sunrise. This was a series of negotiations undertaken between Alan Dulles of the OSS and several American military officers, including then Brigadier General Lyman Lemnitzer, to effect a separate surrender of all Nazi forces in Italy. The person with whom Dulles was conducting these negotiations was SS General Karl Wolff, the number two man in the SS and the personal adjutant to Heinrich Himmler. The outgrowth of these negotiations was basically to help to poison American and Soviet relations even before the guns fell silent at the end of World War II. It also boosted Alan Dulles' reputation as a spy master. It also set the stage for some of the people on both sides of the negotiation, the Sunrise negotiations, to begin their collaboration, which extended into the post-war period. And we're going to see how people like Alan Dulles and Karl Wolff and Lyman Lemnitzer collaborated, and ultimately how Karl Wolff was able to channel information, quote, intelligence, unquote, to Senator Joe McCarthy for the tarring of his targets in the early 1950s, among the targets tarred by Joe McCarthy, people like Lachlan Curry and Harry Dexter White. So we're going to take a look at Darkness at Sunrise in Part 2. Now, in order to understand the events that I've been looking at, not only in this broadcast, but in so many programs, please take advantage of the enormous amount of information on the Spitfire website at www.spitfirelist.com. There are long article-length descriptions of the programs, in particular, often with information that did not appear in the original broadcast. Increasingly, those descriptions are important for an understanding of the program. There are also links to many websites, including sites maintained by sister station WFMU, which is archiving the entire For the Record series on Real Audio. And there's also a mini library of old anti-fascist books, which will give the interested reader a thorough understanding of many of the foundational events to the discussion undertaken. And For the Record, the formation of the international cartel system in particular. So please take advantage of the enormous amount of information on the Spitfire and linked website. This concludes Side 1 of For the Record program number 578, Darkness at Sunrise, the interdiction of Operation Safe Haven. This has been recorded on November 26th of the year 2006. My name is Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.